Okay, we're talking with Al Sparrow. Al, you came here in 72?
Late 72, right.
Okay. What brought you here?
Well, there was I was initially embarked on my academic career at the University of Virginia, where I was a junior pediatric cardiologist, having finished my fellowship in Boston. And after 3 or 4 years there, it was clear there were limited possibilities for my growth, and most of them involving long-term periods of time, much like the U of M system, which you might know here. And about that time, Bill Weil, of course, was recruiting subspecialists for the first time. And Bill invited me up to look around. It was a totally new experience for me. The community-based medical school was a concept I had little knowledge, if any, knowledge of. But I was intrigued with the possibilities for development of myself, my own programs, and furthering my career. So I jumped on the bandwagon and never regretted it.
Do you remember what your first impressions of the school were?
I guess the first impressions were more of community and the university. The school, you refer to the medical school, is kind of a microcosm of that, and it took time to get to know it and feel for it. But my impressions of the community and the university were overwhelming and exciting. As far as the school, in terms of what it was doing, again, that was what intrigued me.
And how was it explained to you? I know it's a long time ago.
Yeah, but it's not forgotten. The educational programs were of an entirely different nature than I was exposed to in traditional medicine all my life. First of all, educating the students in the communities and in multiple communities was new and different and intriguing. And then using practicing physicians as much as we did and do for our educational programs, mm-hmm, was entirely different. I was also impressed with the size of the school, namely its smallness, which was desirable, and the closeness of the student body with the faculty and with the practicing community.
Okay. Was the small group teaching program explained to you?
In terms of my early recruitment, probably not. Probably not.
Okay.
I had no idea the time commitments, if you will, that was going to bring on.
Yeah. Okay. I remember something about our using the large animal clinic as part of our recruitment for you.
That was part of many, many outreach possibilities that were here and may or may not have been used as part of recruitment. But anyway, to stay on that piece, it was a totally new and different opportunity for me. I was coming in that era of pediatric cardiology, it was catheterization oriented, mm-hmm, and catheter diagnosis. And I was very much into invasive cardiology, which parenthetically I've had to give up for various reasons. There was a lot of research going on at the time, not only in terms of techniques for catheterization and catheter diagnosis, but even more importantly in surgical advancements in the ability to correct congenital heart lesions. This ability to diagnose and work and correct obviously had its underpinnings in animal research. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the vet school at that time had a very active, what they called an animal cardiac program, which included catheterization of domestic animals, and indeed surgery of congenital hearts in dogs. And this just fascinated me, and I was an asset to them in terms of bringing my diagnostic experience, and they were an asset to me in letting me do a lot of things that I might not have done otherwise.
Okay. So did you get to work with them?
I did. I worked in their labs quite some time. I catheterized dogs. I interpreted angios for them. And then in terms of intervention, David, I actually opened a dog's chest.
Really?
Bared the heart and actually did a lot of the surgery, which maybe I shouldn't be saying in 2005. But it was under the guidance of the vet surgeons, and they knew that I had this surgical bent, and they were intrigued that let me at least open the chest and close the chest. It was fun. Pediatric cardiologists, they say, are all surgeons in domestic clothes or something.
Surgeons are all thumbs?
No. Surgeons without the surgeon's personality.
Yeah. Okay. But after a while, we had an open heart program for kids here.
We did.
What years were that?
I would guess about the late 1970s. I think Dr. Gonzalez Levine came, okay, first surgeon in, let me think, it may have been 79 or 80, mm-hmm, somewhere in there. And he had been trained in open heart procedures and infant heart surgery in New Zealand, in Auckland, which was at that time a really advanced center for this kind of work. So he and I wanted to set up a surgical program, open heart surgical program for babies and children here. There was none existent at the time in the whole state. So we spent a better part of a month in Auckland with his contacts there, learning their procedures, their techniques, and the intraoperative part of the open heart program, which we then brought back here, set up, and began to do our cases. Our first case was a 3 or 4 week old with a very complicated congenital heart lesion called anomalous pulmonary venous drainage. I remember her to this day, and she required surgery, required it in a hurry, and we successfully operated her, and she's a young adult woman here in the community today.
Okay. And this was done at Ingham?
This program was all at Ingham. The catheterization labs were at Ingham then, the only catheterization labs at the time, and the only open heart program was at Ingham at the time. It was largely, entirely an adult program for coronary artery surgery until we came.
Yep.
And began to expand the program to deal with children.
And what happened to her?
Well, it flourished. It flourished, yeah, actually, for 5 or 6 years. Our results were very, very promising, very, very good. We were all stimulated by our success and very happy in it. There were some few bad outcomes, but in those days, all programs were having these. The beginning of the downfall of the program was not unhappiness of our surgeon, but his inability to really command what he wanted in terms of support, both personal and programmatic. And so we were running into administrative resistance to expand our programs, to expand his personal rewards, and he eventually just decided the future for him was not here, and he moved on to California. We had subsequently had 2 or 3 young surgeons come in with varying expertise, differing backgrounds. I must say the parade of two or three of them over the next course of 6 or 7 years, we never really reached the level we had initially in terms of success and volume.
Where did the resistance come from?
Largely the Department of Surgery's administration. Frankly, you know...
Which has been a problem for 30 years.
Well, right. But the initial chair there who helped me recruit Dr. Levine was Dr. Ed Coppola. Mm-hmm. He was strongly supportive. And as long as he was in charge, we flourished. And then subsequent to that, they moved more toward general surgery, away from high-tech quaternary-type care, and into more basic family-oriented primary care medicine and surgery. It was a pity.
And they moved away from pediatric surgery, didn't they?
Yes. During that period, we also had a pediatric surgical program, and again, quite successful, but again, unable to keep their people happy. And I think two or three people came in and worked a few years and left, went on. And so in the last 10, 20 years, there's been no pediatric surgery of any kind in that department.
Okay. Who did you work with in the early days?
You mean in our department, mostly?
Yeah. Not across campus.
Well, it would a bevy of people across campus, but the people in the department at that time who had come around the time before or after I did were essentially the new people, were all subspecialists. Mike Bailey, of course, was here when I came in nephrology. Don Kaufman joined him. Tom Helmrath was our neonatologist, developed the neonatal unit at Sparrow Hospital. And, of course, Art Corman was Bill's right-hand man, helped him with the administration of the department. And, of course, Bill himself. And then there was an administrator of the department whose name, I believe, was Callan. He watched over the purses and always put us out in the black. Always had enough money in those days.
There was more money in those days.
Oh, he was a marvelous administrator. Yeah. He worked miracles.
Yeah. Was Gita Modi here?
Gita was my first colleague in pediatric cardiology.
I
recruited her out of her fellowship at Babies and Children's in Cleveland.
Okay.
And she and I were together, probably 8 or 10 years, during the course of which we recruited my second colleague and our third pediatric cardiologist, who was...
Radishoff?
No.
Who?
Yes, David Matisoff. Thank you. David came out of Yale, again, with excellent training, excellent clinical capabilities. He was a little bit difficult to work with, not so much for me, but very much so for Gita. They did not get along very well, but I kind of managed to keep the team together until I went on my first sabbatical in 1978-79, and during that sabbatical, Gita became progressively uncomfortable and unhappy with the situation, and actually called me many times describing her difficulty in getting along. Long story short, she went back to India after I came back from sabbatical, and she's remained in India since then. Lovely lady, excellent cardiologist.
Do you ever hear from her?
I do. It was a Christmas card kind of thing for years, and now it's an email thing.
Mm.
So we correspond by email frequently.
Yeah. So what is she doing in India?
She's a pediatric cardiologist, probably the only one in a pretty broad area. I forget. Baroda, I think, is the name of her city. So she does clinical cardiology there and refers her surgical cases to other centers in India. She also had family there for which drew her back, and a mother for whom she cares. And as far as I know, that situation is still going.
And Madisoff left under unhappy circumstances.
David, again, the issue of people wanting to grow faster than the pocketbooks of the university would allow them. David elected to go into private practice but stay in the community. We debated together whether we should try to move the division into the private practice scene, and I just really didn't want to do that. I had too much invested in, I loved what I was doing too much in academic medicine. So again, long story short, we parted on reasonable personal terms and then have become friendly competitors in the community, which in this small community really is not very desirable because the community is so small. But the bad circumstances, it wasn't really that bad. There was a little friction with him and the department administration.
It was supposed to be Ray Holford, wasn't it?
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
We name names on these interviews.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I don't know how much bad stuff you want to get out. You're going to edit it out probably anyway. So,
David, as I recall, didn't both Jean Donansky and Madisoff leave partly over the distribution of funds they were bringing in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was largely, again, financial reward. In David's case also, he had technical requirements, which we couldn't meet at the time. Mm. I should say technical desires, not requirements, which we couldn't meet. And yes, and particularly in Delansky's situation, it was a desire to command more or all of the
resources.
Yeah.
He was bringing the money, he wanted some of it back.
That's right. We were giving it back, but not enough.
Yes.
I've seen this from both sides, the clinician and the administrator, so I know the conflict well.
Talk about the conflict, because it's endemic to the department in a way.
It's endemic to academic medicine.
Yeah.
You know, when you enter academic medicine, I think you understand that you're not going to command the salary that you might have in private practice. And people who come into this do that with that understanding. And they're willing and happy to do it because of the different kind of life that it entails. Namely, a life with students and residents and colleagues and research help and people and not a 40-hour sitting in an office kind of existence, which we all dread. So we know that we're not going to command those kinds of rewards financially, but nonetheless we bring in a lot of money with our clinical practices. And then it becomes an issue of how much that money is returned to the person who generates it, and how much can the department and the college take over, because they need it, obviously, for supporting growth and development as well. So our packages always, as you know, include a base salary and then what we call the health services-related component. And that health services-related component is always under negotiation.
But I think Donansky wanted some of it for his lab, too. It wasn't just salary.
I wasn't that close to it.
Okay.
I wasn't that close. But I know I worked hard with Bill Weil to discourage them moving that division out of the department. I think Bill did what he could, but couldn't do enough to avert that. What really became a disaster when they moved out of the department, and they were in private practice for, 8 or 10 years?
Yep.
And then ended up coming back into the department where they are now.
Dolansky. Yeah.
Well, no, Dolansky never came back.
Neonatology.
Yeah, neonatology came back.
But cardiology has stayed out.
Cardiology is split in and out, right?
Yeah.
We have...
The people who left have stayed out.
Yes.
Okay. I always understood that the way the practice funds were to be distributed in this medical school were different from what was true in most universities. Do you have any insight on that?
I don't think so. I think the big difference, Dave, is that there's more of it in the other universities. These big programs, and take the U of M for instance, their division of pediatric cardiology is as big or bigger than our department of pediatrics.
Yeah.
So they're doing procedures day in and day out and generating funds and seeing patients. And when you have an operation like that, there's more than enough to go around, as it were.
Yeah.
Here, there's a very much limited clinical work to be done and clinical work to be built. And thus, I think that's the big difference. Mm-hmm. Even in major universities, though, the scene is very similar. Namely, there's a basic salary and a clinical salary. Now, in other universities, the clinical salary may be 80-90% of the total. And here, of course, it's far less. So.
Here, you're basically guaranteed a full-time salary with tenure.
Correct. Well, you are not at U of M, too, but that full-time salary might be relatively small.
Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of like, I remember when I left Boston, finished my fellowship, I had just had my fifth daughter at the Boston Lying In, and I was looking at positions, and it was unbelievable the broad nature of the positions that were offered me in terms of salary. Mm-hmm. My mentor, Dr. Natus, really wanted us to stay in Boston, and I remember still he offered me, I think it was $11,000 at that time. And that's all he had to offer because people would stay for that. Unfortunately, I didn't think I could afford to stay for that. So I was offered anything from $11,000 then, and then talking about 1967.
Okay.
Anywhere from $11,000 to $100,000 in some private places. And I kind of took a median position at the University of Virginia. But that shows you the variation in terms of what's available out there, and it all relates to the clinical programs and their ability to generate funds.
Okay. You had a grant for a preventive cardiology program.
We after our sabbatical in 1978-1979, where I went back to Harvard and did a master's in epidemiology at the School of Public Health, became very interested in prevention and in the epidemiology of heart disease. So about the same time, NIH put out a RFP for preventive cardiology programs, the intent of which was to introduce educational programs for medical students in preventive cardiology to get this on the map, as it were, because the idea of prevention then especially was unheard of. So I was in the first class of those awardees and had a 5-year grant to develop this program, which we did from 79 to 84, I think, or 80 to 85. And our approach to that was really exciting. We were able to hire nutritionists. We were able to hire exercise physiologists. We were able to hire behavior change psychologists and had these people help us educate the students and residents at the time around clinical material around high-risk families. The other way we kind of enlisted the students was when they first came here as freshmen in medical school, we put them through a complete workup of risk status for coronary artery disease, all the way from checking their bloods for lipids and cholesterol, to getting nutritional histories and evaluations of their nutrition, their physical status, their exercise tolerance, and their family history of heart disease. So we worked them up as risk factor patients and gave them a chart of all the results of their risk factor status. And it was really quite an exciting program, and the students loved it. We had people in here. During our initial workup, we had to put 105 or 6 medical students through treadmill testing. And we had to enlist 3 or 4 companies who gladly came, brought in their treadmills, manned their treadmills, and staffed them, and helped us run these students through maximum exercise protocols. That was probably the highlight of that program. They really liked that. And the highlight of the highlight was, I'll never forget, the students wanted to show their exercise tolerance and physical activity capabilities. And this one young man was on the treadmill, and I didn't realize at the time, but he had a girlfriend in the class. And she was standing in front of him, telling him that he had to keep going. Motivating him to get through the entire test and to not to quit on the treadmill. Well, this poor guy kept going and going and going, and I finally saw what was happening. I stopped it, and he was like almost about to drop over. Mm. We had to work on him for a couple of hours. He was totally over-exercised and out of complete... he was untrained and shouldn't have been doing what he was doing, but that was our closest episode to near disaster. However, it all worked out fine. But I've never forgotten those two. This young woman egging her boyfriend on the treadmill almost to total exhaustion. That's fun.
Did she know what she was doing?
No, she didn't realize it. She just wanted him to perform. They went on and got married and have a child or two now.
And so the grant ended, and what happened to the program?
The grant ended, and by this time I had created a clinic which evaluated and saw children of high-risk families. That's where there's premature coronary artery disease in some member of the family. And so we couldn't stop the clinic. In fact, it was growing and becoming a real community resource. I was able to staff the clinic, as I said, with a nutritionist, exercise physiologist, and psychologist at first. As the funds ran out, of course, one of the prerequisites of the grant was that the home institution would take over the support when the grant ran out. Mm-hmm. You know, that happens all the time, and then when the grant runs out, there's never any money. So again, long story short, first I became the exercise physiologist. I was most comfortable in that. We terminated the exercise physiologist to save money. Then I think next was the psychologist. And you know me, I'm a psychologist at heart, a real behaviorist. We were able to keep the nutritionist for quite a while. In fact, on a part-time basis, only recently have we lost our nutritionist, so I'm now the nutritionist as well. But what will happen to this clinic is up for discussion right now. After my retirement, Dr. Gobel is interested in it and wants to continue it, but she needs some support, and so far we don't have the support for her. So we're looking at other ways to keep the clinic going.
And there's not any department or college support.
Well, we're talking to medicine, adult cardiology, and hopefully they might help if the department and our department and medicine together would help to support it. It could thrive again. I bet I've seen 200 or 300 families and continue to follow more than 100. So there's a real need for it, and I hope it survives. I may have to be called back to continue it in my retirement. I'll come to you to help negotiate my contract.
You were on the Department Executive Committee in the early days.
Yes, again, I've been on every committee in the department and most of them in the university. My recollection of that, is that what you're after? I think some of your recollection is even before me. I don't remember trips to the local watering station of the executive committee or something like that you told me about.
No, Bill Weil had a drawer full of miniature bottles that he picked up on airplanes.
And that was before my time.
Was it before your time?
Yeah, I don't recall that. I recall you telling me about it, but I don't recall it. But my experience with the executive committee was wonderful. Again, Bill, being the leader that he is and was, let people run with their own programs and develop their own programs. And he was just supportive and in the background and helping. And all of us at that time, we developed endocrinology, as you know. We developed cardiology. Yeah. We developed nephrology and genetics. And it was just an exciting, exciting time. I wish it could have continued that way.
Okay. And then what happened?
Well, I think a lot of things happened. Again, mostly relating to support. The cost of medical care, as you know, is going worse and higher and higher, and the cost of education is greater and greater, as is in the process. I think the department and the college has gone through these incessant budget reductions, which, you know, eventually have bad effects. And I just think we don't have now the support and activity and the programs that we used to have and should have. We become much more oriented to the business of medicine, to the advertising, if you will, selling ourselves, billing and collecting, and I think the business of medicine is where it used to be a 5 or 10% effort in your days. It's become a 85 or 90% effort, and I don't like that.
I got out of administration just in time.
Yes.
Bill was the first chair, and I'm trying to reconstruct the list. Then was Ray acting for a while after Bill retired as chair?
Yes, I think that was when Ray acted.
Yeah, and then Marshall Klaus came.
Before Marshall Klaus came. Marshall was here for 5 years.
Okay. Tell me about Marshall.
Marshall, as you know, is a neonatologist. He was very much into behavioral neonatology, if you will, and perhaps that's why he was here. He wasn't a hands-on neonatologist, but did a lot of research in terms of infant support and infant assessment and that sort of thing. He ran somewhat of a loose ship, not quite like Bill, but pretty much let the other divisions progress as they could. I guess that's pretty much all I don't remember a whole lot about him. In those days, we didn't see the chair much. We were all really busy, and the chair was in the background, and we'd see him at department meetings or recruitment functions, but that's about all. But I remember Marshall as a happy guy, a nice guy, a very devoted doctor of the infant and baby, very much into that. What do you remember of Marshall?
He was an absolutely lousy administrator.
Yeah.
And he delegated everything to Suzanne, what's her name?
Suzanne, now Baker.
Yes.
What was her name then?
I don't remember.
Bennett, Barrett?
But you'd go in and you'd ask Marshall, you'd want to do something that costs money.
He'd send you to Susan.
And Marshall would call Suzanne and say, Suzanne, do we have enough money to do this?
He didn't want to get his hands dirty.
No.
get too much into the difficult stuff.
What happened? Do you have any idea what happened between Marshall and Sparrow Hospital?
You know, I don't. I can't reconstruct the time relations of when the Division of Neonatology came back. I think they were back when Marshall was here. Were they back at Sparrow? I assume so, but I can't imagine him functioning very well at Sparrow if the division was outside the department. Was that, maybe that was a conflict? I don't know.
He complained once that he couldn't practice neonatology in this community and he didn't get any referrals.
Well, this is probably why, when the division was outside, yeah, and they blocked him, I guess. And that's what I remember by his, when I said that he was not much of a hands-on neonatologist, mm-hmm, but I think that was also by desire. But there was a lot of politics going on then, and Gene Delansky was a tough politician.
Yes.
He was a tough guy.
Okay. And then after Marshall, we had Mike Nutzloff as chair.
Yeah, Mike for a few years.
Yes.
Was he acting chair or appointed chair?
He was appointed chair.
And he was not a good administrator. I don't think he was happy in it. People were not very happy with his leadership style. And there was a lot of faculty upset resulting in his departing from the chair in a fairly short period of time, mm-hmm, a couple of years, I think. And that, fortunately or unfortunately, played very much into my career, because it's about the same time that we were losing our ability to do catheterizations, and we had already lost our ability to do open heart surgery. And frankly, I needed more on my plate. And lo and behold, people asked me to try to take over that administrative post, which I probably never would have done, except I was missing those other pieces of my life.
Yeah. Are you glad you did it?
In retrospect, I am. It was a total different experience. Again, something I wasn't aspiring to, but a challenge, and I like challenges. And I think for those almost 10 years, we survived. We didn't go away. We got bigger. We got stronger. And that part of it was pleasing to me. If that hadn't happened to me, I probably would have gone somewhere else where I could have still been catheterizing and being involved in an open heart surgical program. But I didn't really want to leave the department or the community. And strange as it may seem, I became a chair in 82.
Okay. You became chair in
92.
Okay. So Nutzloff was chair during the great budget destruction by the provost.
R-cubed?
Yes.
The R-cubed saga. Yes. Yeah.
The years of the negative incrementals.
I mean, it's just depressing to think about. It just goes on and on and on. Different names, but all resulting in the same thing.
So then tell me about the department you inherited.
Well, I had two large goals when I took over. They were immediately evident to me, two areas of weakness. And those two areas were general pediatrics, which I thought in any department of pediatrics had to be strong and thriving. And believe it or not, we had one general pediatrician at the time when I took over in 92. The other was a similar story in neonatology, which the division had come back into the department, but we had one single neonatologist. Padu Karna was the only neonatologist in our department. She had a DO colleague to help her, but only on a temporary basis. So I set forth to reconstruct or rebuild those divisions, and within a few years we had grown each division to at least five people, which still persists mm-hmm. today. There are five neonatologists and more than five generalists in the department. Both these are the two strongest divisions we have, both in terms of what they do, what they manage, patients they see, and the money they generate. So those two important things, I think, were first on my list. The rest was pretty much guidance and supporting people, everyone again doing their own thing in their various divisions, and then dealing with the cuts and the financial strife with then my administrator, as you know, was Steve Zoff.
Yeah.
And Steve knew the university and knew the system pretty well, and he was great help to me, as you were to Bill in the early days.
Well, my impression is when you became acting chair, the department was pretty much in disarray. The previous chair had done too much micromanaging. And there were a lot of warring factions within the department. Wasn't there another cardiologist at that point?
Yeah, I would guess.
What's his name? He went to Wisconsin.
Michael Portman.
Yes.
Michael Portman.
Yes. How did Portman happen to be hired? Do you have any idea?
Yes. We were looking for support. We had, I guess this happened after David went into private practice.
Okay.
I was alone for a while, which is not a comfortable scene. And so we were recruiting strongly, and Mike came out of NIH, where he had been studying, working with MRI, which is brand new at the time. So I was able to convince whoever was chair at the time. I'm not sure.
Netzloff.
Was it Mike Netzloff?
Yeah.
And Jim Pochens, who was dabbling in MRI at the time, to fund this position, fund it well enough that we could bring Mike in. And Mike came in with a dual appointment and an expectation of research in MRI and radiology. I think he did well in the research arena, working over there. He was not the aggressive, avid clinician that some of us were. He was adequate, but not aggressive. But he clearly had a bent on developing MRI. So he was here, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, and then was recruited to Seattle.
Yeah.
And he's still in Seattle, as far as I know.
He was just a bad fit.
No, nobody much like Mike. Except maybe Jim Pochens. He was a bit of a troublemaker. We didn't we didn't grieve when he departed. And then we were able at that time to bring in Dr. Monica Goebel, who is still here and is just a great fit.
Is she full-time yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's been full-time for a while.
Okay.
Since her kids went to school, I think.
Right.
Had the residency started when you came, or was it started after you came?
No, it was started. well, I don't know about when I came, but soon after, because I remember vividly our first resident, who you recall, Kamal Mohan.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Kamal was a unique person, great pediatrician, and a wonderful guy to work with. And I remember him so well because it was about that time that we had done our first open heart at Ingham. And Conwell literally babysat that kid for 48 hours post-op, never left her side. Was a great resource for us. And I can get you the date of that because I have a newspaper article in my office. I think it was in the 70s.
Make copies of them for me.
All right, yeah. Yeah. I got it's a picture article with Kamal. So yes, the residency was started. It was very small, but it was started, and then, as you know, it's progressed to be quite a strong program with a lot of attraction to American grads and people who have now settled in the community,
mm-hmm.
where all our community pediatricians today are now graduates of our residency program. With the possible exception of Don Knickerbocker, who's almost could have been, because he was part of the establishment of the residency. And then the residency's changed, though, in the last few years when it became integrated with the osteopathic pediatrician's residency, and really it is doing all right in terms of a combined program. It's doing very well, I guess I should say. In terms of a combined program, we do have an ongoing problem with the residency in terms of recruitment.
Why do you think that is?
There's two reasons. I think one is the size. Some people like a small program, others don't. But we are kind of a small program. Second thing is that a lot of people in this medical world don't understand osteopathic medicine.
Mm.
And for that reason, I think are less inclined to apply to our residency. And then the third thing is, through the years, we have been open to foreign grads and have had some wonderful, and continue to have wonderful foreign medical grads in our residency. Largely people who have trained in pediatrics in other countries and come here with a lot of expertise and knowledge and really shine in our program. But again, as you do that, your program becomes less attractive for whatever reason to American grads. They shy away from programs that are too much oriented to the foreign grad, perhaps because of the competition. I don't know.
Yeah. We used to do send questionnaires to people that we interviewed who didn't come.
Yeah. Yeah. You remember any of those results? Any of the things that I've pointed out?
Well, yeah, we were in Lansing.
All right. Lansing, the capital of Michigan.
Yeah. The two major stated reasons where a spouse was going to school someplace else, and they wanted to be in a children's hospital or in a major high-pressure, high-power program.
Right, I didn't make that point, but that's the other point. We are not an Ivy-clad university medical center, which has its drawbacks, but has its positives.
That's
as
right.
Well.
When the residency started, it went to all three hospitals in town.
There were actually four. As you know, the residency only went to three, but we consultants had to go to four, the fourth being Lansing General.
Okay.
And this was, of course, a total misuse of effort and resources. So...
Why?
Just the issue of... I mean, you're just too much time in the car traveling and okay. not being able to organize your life. Seeing one patient here, one patient there, one patient somewhere else, this was crazy. And educationally, it was a terrible waste as well. We couldn't educate well and care for kids well in three different scenes with a small residency. So through the years, we began to contract that and focus more and more on one place, which now, of course, is Sparrow Hospital, where we have the major pediatric unit in the community. I think it was, though people resisted it through the years, it was a good thing to centralize it because we needed to be a lot bigger, to educate and staff two places. We couldn't do it with what we have. There was a lot of competition in those days. There still is, but in those days it was over residencies and over programs, and the hospitals were got down and dirty and fighting for their share of the pot in these programs, and it was difficult to convince sometimes that we had to centralize and organize rather than continue what was a bad use of resources.
Why did we centralize at Sparrow instead of Ingham?
I would guess I would offer two reasons. One, Sparrow was the busier service, had more children, more patients, more community visibility and support. The second thing was the two intensive care units, namely neonatology and peds intensive care, were both at Sparrow. And we needed those two subunits, intensive care units, to have a strong service. As you recall, we attempted to have a pediatric ICU at Ingham during the days of our open heart surgery. Yep. We did have one. Most of the patients in that unit were our open heart patients, but we had competing PEDS ICU programs in the two places for several years, which again, the community is just too small to sustain. Yep. So, though I remember efforts to bring some of Sparrow's PICU, pediatric ICU expertise to Ingham, it never ever got too far. And eventually Ingham just got the dwindles in terms of pediatrics. The heart program went down, open heart program went down. The hematology oncology focused more at Sparrow where they were better supported. And Ingham got into increasing financial problems and eventually closed the service.
And St. Lawrence was a lovely place if you weren't too sick.
If you weren't too sick.
Yes.
Yeah.
You've been here through several deans.
All of the deans.
All of them. With Andy Hunter.
Andy, I don't know, it was probably toward the end of Andy's tenure when I came, but no, he certainly was here several years. Andy was just a likable guy. Fond fellow, friend, quite a visionary, and I think is appropriately recognized for establishing this college and this institution. He was followed by...
Did you work directly with Andy at all?
Not really, no.
Okay.
No. not directly, but I saw him a lot. He was very friendly to our department, as you know.
Yes.
And helped our department grow. Then came our pediatric psychiatrist. Is that right?
Brent.
Then came our pediatric psychiatrist.
Weston.
Donald Weston.
Yep.
Who was, again, a different ball of wax, but again, interestingly, had Andy being a pediatrician and Don Weston being a pediatric psychiatrist, mm-hmm. we continued to roll on and control the college. It was wonderful in those days. Don was very supportive. You didn't see a whole lot of him. He tended to delegate stuff in his office, but really either left us alone or supported us in a good fashion, I think. His tenure was shortened by a couple of adverse events, which we won't talk about, but he's still around, you know. He's still here.
He's in radiology.
He's in radiology. Yeah. Over there with Jim.
Okay. And then?
Then was...
Bill.
Bill Abbott.
Abbott.
Bill Abbott, the... I want to say Ed Psych. Was he in Ed Psych, wasn't he?
Brent?
He was in Ed Psych, Education Psych. And had been in Don Weston's administration and took over. And actually, Bill was dean most of the time that I was chair.
Okay.
Just toward the end that that changed. And again, Bill was a good person. I think maintained the college on an even keel. We didn't see a lot of growth during that tenure, but there was no money to grow by to speak of. Our department grew during there, but that's about all. I knew Bill from his exec committee meetings mostly,
mm-hmm.
and found him supportive and relatively easy to work with. You were still active during Bill Abbott's tenure.
Mm-hmm.
What was your appraisal of Bill's deanship?
I thought he didn't know what he was doing as a medical school dean. He was hostile to the senior faculty in the department.
Yourself?
Hmm?
What senior faculty?
Me.
Yourself?
Bill, Betty, Don.
I never saw that.
I did. He saw us as responsible for Mike Knoxloff's resignation.
Well, you probably were.
We were. We had to save the department.
So why did he blame you for that? I mean, why wasn't he thanking you?
Because he had absolutely no idea, no clue as to what was going on.
But he had placed Mike there.
Yeah. Mike had been his choice. And I remember there was a period of time after Mike had resigned and Ray Helfer was dying in Spain. And nobody knew what Abbott had planned for the department or what was going to happen. Dennis Murray was acting chair. And Dennis eventually laid down the law and said, you know, okay, I've done this for so many weeks. Either I'm going to be a viable candidate for the permanent chairship or I'm stepping down as acting. And he stepped down as acting. At which point, Abbott made me convener of the executive committee.
I remember that.
Okay.
I remember that.
And I remember going to him, telling him, Bill, you have to come and meet with the department.
He says, I have nothing to tell them. There's nothing, not clear yet what's going to happen. And I said, well, you have to come tell them that. And it was just, you know, just a terrible task to get him to do that, but she finally did, which relieved a lot of tension, because at least people knew things weren't going to happen right away. But my impression was that since then, he wasn't willing to go to bat the department faculty. He let John Gurmak leave because he wasn't willing to fight for a tenure line for Gurmak. And when Gurmak was one of the few people bringing in research money and publishing and running the residency. We'd be at a public meeting and somebody turned his back on me.
You know,
which was partly his interpersonal ineptness.
Jovi Scott at one point in time mentioned to me what a terrible dean he was.
Yeah.
How did that? I never really followed up. But where was Jovi coming from, and why was he so upset?
It was Abbott and the provost who said, well, Ingham will be the DL hospital and Sparrow will be the MD hospital.
I mean, it's when we were all still at Ingham, pretty much.
We were both places, yeah.
I think you have a better grasp of this history than I do, because you've probably been talking to a lot of people and been reviewing it.
It's a different perspective, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, you would have had to see him as supportive to state chair for all those years.
Yeah. And I think he was pleased. I thought he was pleased with what was happening in the department in terms of new people and growth, but clearly not about senior faculty.
Mm-hmm. And I never felt, and I may be wrong on this, but I never felt that he was really willing to go to the mat with the provost about the medical school budget.
He had a difficult relationship with the provost.
I mean,
That was tough. I mean, look what our present dean is going through with the provost and now president. I mean, it's still dreadful, just dreadful.
You know, on the one hand, Abbott was saying to the physicians, you have to bring in more practice money. And on the other hand, was saying, well, you can't compete with our local practitioners because we're a community-based medical school.
I didn't hear him say that. We used to say that in the early days.
Yep.
We were very careful, and I remember always pricing our services over the community so we wouldn't be competing with them. Remember that? And now, of course, you compete nail to nail, tooth to tooth.
Tooth to tooth, and Blue Cross decides how much you get paid anyhow.
Yeah.
What about the present chair, who I barely know?
Dr. Davies is a really nice person. I'm not sure he knew what he was getting into when he came here. It's just been a horrible time to be chair. And he's got to be, I know he feels it, but he's stuck in there, he's working hard, he is, has done a, established a lot of good things already.
What kind of things?
Well, he's took on the development piece and has worked to create a supportive development activity in, what do they call it, the Mid-Michigan Children's thing or something. And that, you know, that's grown from nothing to a real viable, voluntarily but well-staffed group of people who are, I think will end up bringing in, hopefully bringing in lots of support. It's still relatively small, but it will grow. So he's taken that on, which I never wanted to do. I can't stand fundraising.
Yeah.
I just don't do fundraising. But that's been a good effort. He's also tried to promote research in the department. He's created our annual research day, which we had more or less informally before, but he's formalized it and advertised it, and it's coming up, incidentally, in May. And I think that's been a very positive thing. And then he's run his poor backside back and forth to Grand Rapids, trying to keep that situation under control and not having it erupt or not having it end up with him taking up residence there, which at one point in time was supposedly ordained and was going to happen. And it still may, but so far it hasn't. But I think to be chair now, with all of this going on in Grand Rapids, the financial constraints, the recruiting problems, I mean, it's very hard to recruit here now with this uncertainty and instability.
Right.
We're finding that in cardiology, just seeking my replacement. It's been very, very difficult. Whereas we were seeking at least a mid-career tenurable or tenured person, we're currently revisiting that, and we'll probably have to look for a more junior person in a non-tenured slot, in a health program slot.
Will you be replaced with a tenure line?
I was to be, but they've been looking for a year now, and we've had one or two candidates, neither of which has panned out. So that's the question now. Shall we change this position to a health programs position?
At one point, the provost said there would be no more tenure line positions in the medical school. The tenure would be in a basic science department.
Well, I think she has agreed to keep my line there. I know that. Maybe there'll be no new ones, but hopefully we can keep the old ones. Speaking of Grand Rapids, the more and more I'm hearing the community gossip, and again, I can't speak from real knowledge, but community gossip is, and I'd be anxious to hear what you have heard about this, that's the intention of the university administration that the MD school be in Grand Rapids and the DO school take over the Lansing campus. Have you heard that?
I have not heard that, but I'm no longer in the rumor mill.
I think that would be a disaster.
I do know when I came here, I was told that Grand Rapids had originally wanted the medical school to be in Grand Rapids.
That's true, yeah. Don Waterman days. Don Waterman told them that they should put it there. And again, because of the existence and support of basic science, the decision was made not to, to put it here. And that hasn't changed. It seems to me it would be a big mistake to abandon this campus for MD training purposes. I hope it doesn't happen.
If the medical school had been in Grand Rapids, would you have come here?
I guess I can't answer that because I don't know what the Grand Rapids scene would have been like in those days. Probably not. Probably not. Today I might. There's so much going on there in terms of development and money and growth, both population growth and science growth. And I mean, they have more subspecialists in pediatrics than we do now. They're all in private practice.
Yep.
They still have the numbers, and they're seeing patients, and they're generating a lot of money. So I might come today, if it were 1972. I probably wouldn't have come in 1972. Yep. I wanted the university community.
You're nearing retirement.
Very.
When?
I will go on a consultantship here in July.
Really?
And July 05, and terminate in July 06. And we're now working out what my responsibilities will be in the consultantship year. It's very tenuous and scary because Monica Gobel is very concerned about the support that she might not have, and our inability to have any real recruitment going on. So I'm trepidous about this transition. Yeah. And I think Deli is too. And I know Monica is. So we will see. I want the division and the department, obviously, to thrive and survive, and I'll do everything I can to help make that happen. But it's going to be a tough period.
What will you do during retirement?
Professionally, I have kind of three areas that I'm going to continue to work in. One is with the State Medical Society and the Department of Community Health and my other community contacts in this Medicaid mess here. Yeah. We are really in a crisis, not only in the U.S., but particularly in the state, in terms of Medicaid funding and coverage. And as you know, the governor's recently proposed a doctor tax,
yeah,
which is very controversial, and the State Medical Society is vehemently against. And I'm, of course, a representative to the State Medical Society, and I think that notion has perhaps some salvation if it can be made on a voluntary basis or something. We're going to explore that. Mm-hmm. If some physicians at least would voluntarily recognize that we have to be leaders in support of this somehow or other. Yeah. And then to look at alternate survival mechanisms for Medicaid. And particularly here, I see a crisis. It's been there, but it's getting worse. The hospitals are under intense pressure to get their length of stays down and get their patients out. So these discharge planners are pushing these patients out to wherever they can, namely these nursing homes, right, which are proliferating to accommodate and the patients, but quality-wise are, in many cases, just disasters. And so we're decreasing the hospital funding and length of stay and increasing this nursing home piece, which is eating up tremendous amounts of funds.
And not paying for home care.
And not paying for home care and not paying for quality care.
Yeah.
So that's one area, Medicaid. The other thing, I may have mentioned this to you, we're talking with David Prestel and Professor Malik. Malik is in engineering and has had a study abroad program for his engineers for years in Russia. Mm. And David Prestel is chair of linguistics and a Russian professor. And his students go there. So they are interested, and there's a medical institute in Volgograd where they go. And the institute is interested in getting medical students there. So I'm in talking stages with them about seeing if we can make this happen somehow or other. It will be fun.
Yeah.
And the final thing, we have a departmental obesity program, obesity prevention program, which Dr. Anelli is heading largely, and I continue to contribute to that and work with that, maybe through my prevention clinic as well. Mm-hmm. So I can be busy professionally as much as I want. Personally, I'm going to try to travel. see grandchildren and children.
Yep. That's part of the fun of retirement.
Spend more time in warm climates.
Yeah.
Is that what you were doing in Boston? Seeing family?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Summarize 30 years in the department for me.
Wow. it was just so much different than I expected when I finished training. I expected to be a traditional subspecialist in an ivory tower center doing the things I had done in my training years. And as we've talked already, I was able to do that for a short period here, not in an ivory tower huge center, but the same kind of programs. But then everything changed. There was never a big medical center. There was never a tertiary care center. There was never a major heart vascular center. Students were always being educated in the communities and not at the bedside.
Mm-hmm.
Residents were different than the residents I had been exposed to and the residents that I was. So it was a total change in expectation, and yet a very appealing change.
Mm-hmm.
I have no regrets that my career was spent largely here. The community of the college and the university and the community itself have been absolutely rewarding. Raising 5 daughters in this environment couldn't have been better. It could have been a hell of a lot worse.
Yep.
And then summing it entirely up, it went so fast. I can't believe how fast 30 years goes. I tell my children that now. You've got to start thinking of what you're doing, where you're going, what you're accomplishing, because before you know it, you'll be grandparents. So very positive. It's kind of the same thing people expect. Well, maybe you're not happy that you spent so much time here. And the same thing when we all had to go in the military. People said, well, that must have been awful. Well, no, there were good things in the military.
Yeah.
I had fun in the military. I made good friends in the military. So it's largely what you make of your surroundings and your environment. And it's a give and take, and it's been very pleasant.
Were you involved in teaching things like focal problems?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, I still am.
Still am. Lucky you.
still do the problem-based stuff
mm-hmm.
and enjoy it. And again, that was one of the big changes. Clinical faculty in major institutions, as you know, don't do that, although they're starting to. And
mm-hmm.
we've been pioneering that. I think it's definitely the way to go. It's good for the professor. It's good for the student.
Yeah.
It's actually fun. And I think it's made our educational programs much stronger and much more desirable to the student. They love it.
Mm-hmm. I saw some boilerplate on the newspaper the other day about a special program at Harvard where they're teaching students how to interview patients.
I saw that. I saw that as well. We've definitely mm-hmm. been pioneering in many, many areas,
mm-hmm.
Educational areas, absolutely. And I think that's been our strength and continues to be. Hope we can continue mm-hmm. to do it.
Okay. The other question is, the department's always had a reputation of being a kind of a special place. I don't know whether you agree with that or not.
Oh, yeah, I do. I think it becoming less special as time goes on. It's becoming more, more ordinary, if you will. But in the earlier days, there was a camaraderie, a closeness, a supportive atmosphere, which was delightful. Being the first pediatric cardiologist in this whole area, I had to reach out to others for support and people to talk to, but I found them. I found them across campus. I found them within our department. It was special and good and easy. You mentioned earlier, you asked me about people I work with, and I didn't talk about people outside the department. But again, one of the attractions and one of the nice things that I'll remember is our ability to work outside the department, to work in the nutrition department, to work in physiology, doing research efforts much like we did in the vet med school thing. I've worked all over this campus and have made friends and done things, and which isn't possible in a major university atmosphere. So, it was different. It was close. It was supportive. It was comfortable. It's not quite the same now. We lost all those huggy people.
Do you think that even can be recaptured?
I doubt it. I think that life has changed too much. Change goes on incessantly. It's not always for the better, but it's going to go on. No, I don't think we'll ever have the same thing we had in the 80s, 70s. And that's okay, I guess, but be people taking our places that find their needs met other ways, I guess.
Yeah. Any advice for the next chair?
The next chair? You got Deli out of here already?
No. Any advice for Deli?
For Deli, I just watch your back. That's all. Boy, Deli, watch your back. No, not really. I think the next few years is going to be a kind of a tidal basin. And there's nothing real good is going to happen until we stabilize, figure out the Grand Rapids situation, and then get on to the next phase of the college and the department. And there is going to be a next phase. It'll be totally different from the present, and particularly from what you and I knew earlier. It'll probably be much more like a major center, probably in Grand Rapids.
In Grand Rapids. Sort of divorced from a major university.
Well, that's the craziness of it, yeah. But you can have a major university, a major medical center, kind of like a Mayo Clinic or something.
Yeah.
You know, that model.
I think that's realistic.
Not in the near future, but ultimately, yeah. I think it'll be a transition over 10 years or more. You won't know the place in 10 years.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.